you know, nice and turning people into horrible monsters.
Yeah.
Because who wouldn't want to be a horrible monster?
Exactly.
Thanks, Lou.
As long as you're nice.
Yeah.
A nice horrible monster. Live from the Mundangerous Lightning Rail Station in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 33 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're talking about our favorite campaign setting, the noir-inspired Eberron. But first, the party examines their latest prophecy in the Morning Glory campaign, and the gatekeeper druid helps keep Zoriat at bay in the Character Creation Forge.
Alright, before we get into our Eberron-packed episode of Eberron about our Eberron campaign and Eberron as a campaign setting and our character creation forge based on Eberron.
Why don't you tell us about EberronCon?
Okay, how about a catacon?
Oh, right.
Because that's a real thing. So, yeah, it's that time of year almost. So a catacon 2016 is happening on November 11th through 13th. But the Kickstarter with which to buy badges is going live on April 21st. So it's about 6 weeks from now, but I wanted to go ahead and announce it in case you are interested in coming and meeting up with me. I will be one of these special guests, which is hilarious that I'm even a guest. Alongside me are some actual special guests. Last year, I know John Wick, the creator of Legends of Five Rings, also 7th Sea. I think they're at $750,000 on Kickstarter right now for their second edition.
I mean, it's been forever since first edition, everyone is excited.
Everyone wants it, yeah. So John Wick came, played a whole bunch of games, ran a bunch of games. Everyone got a chance to talk to him. He was pretty amusing. We also, last year, had the guy who wrote Birthright and Primeval Thule, Rich Baker, was amazing. Played in one of his games. So, and then all of the guys and girls from the RPG Academy podcast network will be there. So it was a great time. It's lots of role-playing games. We played lots of indie games. People were playtesting, as well as lots of D&D and sort of more traditional games. So it was a blast. It is in Dayton, Ohio this year, in the middle of civilization. So that's nice. It will not be an hour and 15-minute drive outside to the middle of the woods and a hotel covered in birds of prey. They were literally ravens circling around. It was a little special.
It makes me glad that I got to play my catacomb game from the comfort of my own home.
It was a great venue. It was just a little inconvenient. So this year it is at the Dayton Convention Center in downtown Dayton, where I am assured there are plenty of hotels and restaurants nearby within walking distance, and I won't need a car, which I'm super psyched about. So repeat those dates. A catacomb is from November 11th to November 13th in Dayton, Ohio. And the Kickstarter will go live on April 21st.
So get in line, because that's how the internet works.
Actually, it funded on the first day last year. So they use Kickstarter, and they set their funding goal at the absolute minimum they need to hold the con. And then they use anything that goes over to fund the special guests coming and that sort of stuff. Again, for the actual special guests.
You're a special guest.
I'm special. But yeah, last year they hit the funding goal in the first day, and it was awesome. So I want to support our friends, Michael and Caleb.
Yeah, I hang out with Shane all the time, and it costs me way more than going to a catacomb.
Yeah.
Yeah, mostly in dignity.
And respect.
Mm-hmm.
All right, speaking of dignity and respect, what's going on in the Morning Glory campaign?
Well, the party finally got kitted out with new gear, thanks to the Angels of New Metrol. And you're all putting your heads together, figuring out what the heck is going on. Why are you all stuck here? You realize there's a dimensional lock on the entire, I guess, dimension. So none of you can teleport away. You need to figure out a way to get out of here. But you also received your second prophecy, which was overheard by the Deva Diri, whom you rescued, coming out of the mouth of your devil companion Behemoth. And it's unclear whether Behemoth actually knows that he made a prophecy.
Yeah, because Behemoth is a jerk and played coy, and we didn't trust him enough to tell him about the prophecy.
Yeah, which is probably a good idea.
Right.
So you're at a council of angels who are very intelligent and very wise. So the way that I got around them just looking at this prophecy and riddle and going, oh, here's what it actually means, was basically hand-waving it and saying, prophecies are structured in such a way that only the people they're about can truly understand them.
Which is really funny, because this prophecy we actually figured out much faster than the first prophecy.
Well, I also wrote it to be much more clear.
That's also true.
Because I was starting to feel like, okay, you guys really, really need some direction. Because we'd finally gotten to the point in the campaign where the true scope of it was beginning to become clear to you. Seer wasn't completely destroyed. There are fiendish overlords buried in the ground. And something very bad is coming. You're thinking probably a second day of mourning.
Right.
Maybe a worse one.
Right.
So you know that you are trying to stop that in some way, but also I wanted to rope the characters in so that in game they all felt like there was a reason that they specifically were on this quest.
So what's the prophecy?
Born of primal murder's pride, dragon spawn and Dolor's bride, all find disparate goals allied and seek the half-elf suicide. Now to make the cage undone, a key lies with the painted one, orphan, soulbound, wayward son, the empty vessel, voice of none.
Here we go again.
So there are two stanzas there, and you toyed around with the first stanza a bit. Primal murder's pride, dragon's bond, Dolor's bride.
Yeah.
Not really sure what's going on there. Yeah,
well, we thought at first was primal murder's pride sounded an awful lot like our Warforged monk Bastion. And then even more so, dragon spawn sounded an awful lot like Brand, mm-hmm. given his draconic sorcerer lineage.
Right. And three of you were half-elves.
Right.
So
we initially thought the first stanza was about us. And then when we counted the examples in the second stanza, mm-hmm. I think we began to suspect that that was about us, though we didn't quite have it all figured out.
Right.
We figured painted one meant the dragon mark that Bahar had.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we figured out soulbound. Well, no, actually, I think the rest of them we still weren't sure on, because we weren't sure if the empty vessel was Emery having no soul,
right,
or soulbound being Emery having her soul being possessed by devils.
And Bahar now knew that he was an orphan.
Right, right. So we had multiple orphans. We had wayward son and voice of none were both potentially Brand,
uh-huh.
as it was not clear sort of what his affiliation with the Inquisition was at this particular moment.
Was he an orphan?
Well, he was old.
He was like 42.
Yeah, he was old enough that his parents were no longer a part of his life. So I guess, yes.
Because I think I remember a time when you were like, oh, yeah, no, they're just retired cobblers.
I think that's right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was
they're
just
nothing
like,
special.
They were just unremarkable.
They're not dead. But
maybe one
weird.
Of them was dead, I don't know.
That's macabre.
It's one of those things, right, where like the job just takes over.
You know, I'm sure I should go call them or something.
Yeah, it's like they thought that I was like a delivery guy, you know, and they like weren't proud of me. It's like, because you can't just tell people you're in the Inquisition. That's sort of the trick of the Inquisition, right?
Right, and you can't tell them that you're someone big and powerful.
Right.
Because then they want to ask about it. They want to like cash in favors. No, I'm no one.
You've got top secret clearance. It's a theocracy, so you've got all these knowledge of deific doings and such, heresies and prophecy. Ugh, that's a big... There's a lot of red tape to have a family, is what I'm saying.
Right, and they're wondering why, like, when you do visit, you're like, oh, yeah, don't light those candles in that order. Just, no reason, no
yeah,
reason. Just... I'm OCD, no reason. Here, I put silver in your food. Why? No reason.
It'll be fine. Just want to make sure you're not werewolves.
Shifty shifters.
So, yeah, so we quickly latched on to the idea that the last stanza was about us. We just weren't sure which of us was which.
Right. But from then on, once you realize probably none of the half-elves in the party were the one referred to by the half-elf suicide,
right.
Every single time you met a new NPC, you all said, are they a half-elf?
Right.
Do they seem sad or depressed?
Right.
What if we polymorph them into a half-elf?
Right. All right, so that concludes the first section of our All Eberron episode. Let's move on to our main topic for the day, which is Eberron as a campaign setting.
So this is the first installment of our campaign setting dossiers. We'll be doing other campaign settings in the future. The point of this isn't to just give you sort of an encyclopedia version of these campaign settings. We want to give you the information that GMs and players need to know in order to determine if they actually want to play in this setting.
Yeah, so some of it's going to be facts of the setting. Some of it's going to be our opinions and experiences with the setting. And hopefully at the end of it, you'll have an idea if this place excites you and is worth picking up a book, or if, you know what? No, not for me.
Mm-hmm.
And shout out to Melissa for requesting this. I don't think she was specifically asking about Eberron, but she was curious about other settings that are published by Wizards and our take on them and what you would need to know as a new player. So
she had to know this is where it would end up.
I mean, just on account of our laziness, it would have to, right?
Which one do we know best?
The one we need the least amount of research, yeah.
And also the one that, you know, we actually enjoy playing. I think Forgotten Realms will be a little tougher.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm dreading
that
one.
Why should you play that? Well,
because you don't have Eberron. Because they haven't released a Dark Sun book yet.
Inertia?
Yeah. It's got 100% of the supplements until Curse of Strahd.
Maybe you're Ed Greenwood.
Right. Say, if your last name is Salvatore. All right. So back to Eberron, though. What's the elevator pitch for Eberron?
It was originally designed in 3.5 by Keith Baker to be a setting where anything that you find in D&D would make sense.
Yeah, it was part of a competition that Wizards held, mm-hmm. Where they solicited openly the community. There were various stages of the competition where contestants had to submit sort of increasingly complex submissions, and then the winner was chosen based on their pitch and then became a developer on the setting alongside the sort of existing staff of Wizards of the Coast.
Mm-hmm. So Eberron is that setting where magic is recognized as fundamental, and then the history of the setting is extrapolated based on the existence of magic. It becomes the new technology. So the technological level of the setting is a little bit higher than you traditionally get in a fantasy setting. It's almost Victorian, steampunkish. There's even elements of film noir, detective novels, things like that.
Yeah, it gets accused of being steampunk a lot, but I think it's kind of probably more magipunk, right? But it definitely has that noir feel, the high adventure feel.
I mean, you bound the fire elemental and then you put it under a pot of water and that boiled the water and that created steam. I think that's still a steam engine.
But what that means for players is that there's lots of magic. And from a sort of class and level distinction, that means there's basically lots of third level casters running around. It's mm-hmm. just part of daily life. There's not lots of 20th level heroes running around. There's no Elminster. There's no Drizzts. Heads of state are in the teens mm-hmm. of level. So there's sort of this broad base of magical competence, but then there's a very limit to high level magic. So you don't have the sort of bonkers of Greyhawk, where you've got the Council of Eight, where Dromige and Mordenkainen, they have their names in the PHB, right? Like, it's tough to eclipse them. Whereas eventually, you know, in a 1 to 20 campaign, you will be probably the most powerful mortals in Eberron.
Mm-hmm.
That's where you get that noir feel, is that it's high fantasy, but low power.
Right. As players, you can actually affect change and feel like you eventually become a real mover and shaker in the world.
Yeah.
So when the campaign setting opens, a 100-year war on the continent of Corvair has just ended 2 years prior.
Yeah, Corvair is the sort of main continent of the humanoid races.
It had initially, for nearly 1,000 years, been united under the throne of Galifar, which broke apart when five scions of the house decided that each one of them wanted to be the new emperor.
Right.
And that led to 100 years of war, which has many historical parallels to, well, the actual 100 years war.
Right, right.
But then also, probably more so, World War I, where there are all kinds of new technologies on the battlefield that hadn't been utilized in mass warfare before. So you have magical atrocities and entire squads of wizards wielding wands.
Right.
Facing off against what initially were sentient golems created to fight as war machines.
Right. And then you get that sort of punk overlay when you talk about the dragon-marked houses, mm-hmm. which are the sort of corporate figures of Corvair, where they are neutral in regards to nations. They are selected based on the ability to manifest a magical dragon mark on your skin, which is basically looks like a tattoo. Maybe it moves a little bit more than a tattoo. But they sort of hold their own agendas, right? They've sort of divided themselves up into what they do based on the powers from their dragon marks, but they're sort of above the fray, right? They're kind of profiting on all sides for the most part.
Right. Depending on who you ask in the setting, they're either like the East India Company or the Yakuza.
Yeah. Yeah. And depending on which house.
Right. Yeah. So the turning point of the setting happens 2 years prior to when the baseline setting happens, which is the destruction of the entire nation of Seer in a magical cataclysm that left a gaping wound in the earth and a horrible place full of abominations and death called the Mornland. You may have heard about it if you listen to the podcast.
Yeah, yeah. We spent 32 episodes or so dealing with that.
And in much the same way that the atomic bomb ended World War II, this ended the last war, mainly because one of the secrets of the setting, or mysteries of the setting, really, because there's no actual answer, is what caused the Day of Mourning. Many of the nations think that it was some sort of horrible weapon that's just waiting to be recharged. And so there's a Cold War. There's a very uncertain peace. Everyone is moving ahead with their lives and trying to figure out what life is like when you're not actually fighting a war, but everyone knows that it could break out at any time again.
Yeah, what I like about it as a Cold War analog is the different nations of Corvair sort of have their parallels with European powers,
mm-hmm.
right? So it makes it very easy to sort of identify which nations are which as you're mapping out your Cold War. But then the twist is no one knows what caused it. Right? It's this ongoing mystery of what the cause was. So no one's really sure who has the bomb and who doesn't.
Right.
Right.
In the real world, Truman was trumpeting it. Look right. What we did. We'll do it again.
Right.
Okay, and we did it again. Look.
Yeah. Everyone knew that we had it and everyone knew that Russia had it.
Mm-hmm.
What if Russia thought we had it and we thought Russia had it and neither of us had it? Right.
Or no one would admit to having it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Because it actually could be that as a GM, you decide that Breland caused the Day of Mourning.
Right.
King Borinel.
And they've managed to keep it secret for at least 2 years. That's actually a great starting point was, you know, you recovered the Death Star plans. Right. Many Bothans died. And now you're returning home to Thrain or wherever. Oh my God, that would be amazing. We know how to make another one.
Another defining characteristic of Eberron that I really like a lot is the way that it treats traditional D&D alignment. It's all shades of gray. Chromatic dragons aren't necessarily evil. Metallic dragons aren't necessarily good. Orcs and other monstrous humanoids can make the same kinds of moral choices that regular humanoids can make.
Except for shifters. Shifters are all evil. They had to die.
That is the silver flame still talking.
Right. No, in fact, there's an entire nation that's comprised of monstrous humanoids.
Mm-hmm. Run by, I think maybe a Medusa is rumored to be the head of it, the Queen of Stone.
I think that's right.
Mm-hmm. It's a cool place to adventure. I think actually Keith Baker said it's his favorite place to adventure.
I would believe it.
I gave you guys the option way back at the very beginning of the campaign, shortly before you actually showed up, to see if that was the direction that you wanted to go. Because I started the Caves of Chaos, I stuck them in the Greywall Mountains, and I said, okay, in this direction is Sharn and like film noir and tall towers and like crazy
political
lightning
intrigue
rails.
And mystery.
And on the other side of these mountains is a nation run by monsters. And I think like, you know, two or three people were like, oh, yeah, yeah. But then everyone was like, okay, but we want to see Sharn.
Right, right.
Let's see Sharn. Also, the motivations of the traditional good guys versus bad guys aren't clear cut. You have people who are trying to do the right thing, but maybe use underhanded or illegal methods to do it. and you have people who just want to amass power and, you know, consolidate, who often can make the lives of the people that they rule better in the short term anyway.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it's also a great setting for intrigue and politics in your game. We mentioned the dragon marked houses earlier as sort of these independent corporation type figures, right, that exist outside of normal national boundaries. But what else is there?
There's plenty of opportunity for cloak and dagger shenanigans. Like I said before, Eberron has a higher level of technology than most fantasy settings. So a great number of people live in large cities and urban and metropolitan areas rather than sort of out in the country as peasants.
Yeah.
So you've got huge towers in Sharn. You've got giant castles in Rote. Lots of opportunities for urban adventures, for the kinds of political maneuvering that exists around centers of power and people who exercise their might not through their sword, but through their laws or their scepter.
Yeah.
As a GM, I really like that the multiple nations of Corvair and the multiple Dragonmark houses all have different personalities,
right,
in a way, which means that you can use one or more of them almost as characters in the story that you're telling. And players can also pick from any one of these to be from. And then that can help inform how they view the world and what kind of ties that they have.
Yeah. In our game, House Caneth sort of became the de facto evil house.
That was mainly because Kallik decided very early on that they were the ones who caused the Day of Mourning and killed his family.
Right, right. But if you go on to like the Eberron Reddit, or you go on to the old Eberron forums from the Wizards forums, RIP, people wanted to make characters in House Caneth.
Mm-hmm.
And looking at that now, like, I have this lens of like, nope, can't do that. They're evil. Like, you're playing for the wrong team.
They're
right?
Really lawful neutral is right, the way I always,
right.
Yeah.
They're pure technologists, mm-hmm. right? I mean, that's sort of their thing is innovation. They're the artificers who developed the Warforged.
Right. They have the mark of making. It makes it much easier for them to build and create things out of nothing.
Right. And so there's nothing inherently evil there, right? But in our campaign,
you know, unless you're an Ashbound druid.
Okay, fair enough. But that became sort of a piece of our campaign, right? Was fixing the evil of House Caneth so that they would not perpetrate another Day of Mourning with their hubris.
One head at a time.
Right. Yeah, we've already, at this point, we've already killed just one so far, right? Just Zorlan.
There's Jorlana, who's still alive.
Right.
And Merix.
Right. Well, yeah. So let's talk about religion, because unlike Forgotten Realms and some of the more traditional fantasy settings, there's not a lot of deities that have any sort of direct impact.
Yeah, they don't walk the world with mortals. They don't talk to them, except for, you know, his facelessness, the Traveler.
The Traveler and then the Silver Flame, right?
Right, a relatively new god.
Right.
There's a pantheon of 15 gods.
Wow, I didn't realize it was that large.
Yeah, 9 good-ish and then 6 evil-ish.
Right.
Right. Again, alignment is kind of...
Yeah, generally pro-civilization and anti-civilization is probably the better way to think of it.
Yeah,
right?
That's a much better split. And because they don't really interact on a day-to-day level, people can interpret their teachings pretty much any way that they want, sort of like in the real world, which I personally feel like leads to much more interesting stories and potential RP, because you can have people who both worship the exact same god in the exact same town, and they totally disagree on how that's supposed to be expressed.
Right. Or you can have actual non-believers, right?
Yeah.
It's sort of one of the problems I have with Forgotten Realms and Greyhawk is like, you have to choose a god to worship because they're extremely powerful. You're an idiot if you don't worship one.
Like, they're standing right there.
Right.
They come by once a week.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? Oh, here's an earthquake. And you know?
Right, right.
And of course, if you don't, Forgotten Realms, you end up in the Wall of the Faithless, which just sucks after you die.
Lame.
Super lame. But in Eberron, that doesn't happen. In fact, you can make new gods.
Yeah, right. There's cults.
You know, every religion starts as a cult.
That's true. Mm-hmm. The Cult of Lu is still recruiting, I believe.
That's right.
It's still waiting for its first member.
But one of the central tensions among the faithful on Eberron is these sort of older, more traditional gods, and then the new Church of the Silver Flame, which is very evangelical and very zealous.
Right. So the Church of the Silver Flame is the power center.
Tell us, O Inquisitor Brand.
It's the seat of government as well for Thrain, the nation, one of the five nations that fought in the last war. Right.
The only theocracy.
Right, exactly. So being a theocracy, the religion is extremely major focus. And then it's also got this sort of weirdness in that within the Church of the Silver Flame, they know that the Silver Flame exists, right? It is a thing that is physically manifested in the world.
Yeah, they built a castle around it.
Right. The religion is whether or not it's a god. They believe that's a god, and no one else can really deny that it exists outside of sort of the conspiracy theorists, but whether or not to worship it is sort of the question for the traditional pantheon, right? Mm-hmm. Or for traditional believers.
And then even people who aren't interested in religion per se end up dealing with the Church of the Silver Flame because they come to meet you.
They're extremely militant. Yeah, they are. I mean, it's the Spanish Inquisition.
Yeah.
there's no two ways about it. They led a campaign murdering all of the shifters.
It was a genocide.
It was a Holocaust of shifters. Yeah. One of the evils they've perpetrated in the name of the Silver Flame, right? Mm-hmm. And then the people of Thrain live in relative wealth and prosperity within their borders. So it's kind of that double-edged sword. And then within the church, there's the Inquisition, which is extremely powerful. And then on top of that, you've got the Keeper of the Flame, who can speak to the Silver Flame and actually commune with the deity itself.
Who in canon is an 11-year-old girl.
Yes. She is the Lollipop.
Right.
And she is a very Pope-like figure. The creation myth of the Silver Flame is that there is a paladin, a quaddle, and a fiend bound within the Silver Flame.
Mm-hmm.
It was the paladin's way and the quaddle's way of binding the fiend so that it could not wreak any more havoc on the world.
Yeah, it ties into a central tenet of Eberron that I really like, but although it's more unspoken, is that you can never truly vanquish evil.
Yeah.
So the paladin couldn't kill the fiend. It could only bind it, and so she is trapped there with it as well.
Right. And so it is the paladin that speaks to the keeper.
So they say.
Right. No way that fiend ever gets out.
Goodness and virtue always triumphs.
Right.
Thus saith the flame. And then, like you mentioned before, there are quite a few cults. And I love that you can just make a new one if mm-hmm. you want, because, mm-hmm. you know, they pop up like crazy. But there are canon cults as well. There's the Blood of Vol, which seeks divinity from the inside through increasing your own personal power.
They're basically real-world Satanists. It's sort of the power of self.
Yeah, right? Except that it actually works.
Well, right. Well, because there's magic.
And then the Cult of the Dragon Below, which worships all kinds of just crazy things. It's not one particular cult. It's just there's tiny cults that get lumped together as Cult of the Dragon Below, and they worship random aberrations, creepy abominations, or horrible things trapped in the Underdark.
Right, and then you can kind of create your own cults, like you said, around certain relatively powerful figures, right? You could have cults of personality, which is basically what the Cult of Lu was,
right.
A worship of aberrant creatures, as long as they're nice.
Or the Elves of Arranel, who embalm their dead into a kind of anti-undead, and then the entire conglomeration of them together is worshipped enough that it became its own deity. It makes sense.
It's special.
Yeah.
There's also ample opportunity for dungeon crawls.
Right. We definitely don't want to portray Eberron as a place that is too metropolitan. There are absolutely wild places, and there are ancient places, and there are horrible places underground. And these are all great to find ancient treasures and get some of that XP.
Oh, yeah. There's plenty of places to put your Caves of Chaos. There's plenty of trips into Soriat.
Do you need a Temple of Elemental Evil? Yep.
Right.
No problem. Man. Tomb of Horrors? Yep, one on every corner.
Exactly. Another sort of iconic piece of Eberron is the special races.
Mm-hmm.
So within 5th edition, we had the Unearthed Arcana, covered a couple of them. The Warforged, which are humanoid golem type creatures made from metal. Think Iron Man, except no rockets.
Well, I mean, you find an enterprising artificer and anything's possible.
Fair enough. There are the Changelings, which are shapeshifters.
And the Kalishtar, who are essentially psionic monks.
Yeah, and since you need psionics in order to have psionic monks, we're still waiting on the Kalishtar.
Yeah, we'll get there eventually. So some people don't like these particular races. They find that, you know, they don't really fit the flavor of other campaign settings. I think they work great. I think the Warforged are extremely intriguing. I mean, the main question in our campaign and, you know, in canon as well is, do Warforged have souls?
Right.
Because they're a race that's only 33 years old and they're created in factories, essentially.
Right.
And the Changelings, well, really the reason the Changeling exists is because people love doppelgangers, but doppelgangers are so overpowered with their detect thoughts ability that the Changelings are basically just a PC version of the doppelganger.
They
basically strip everything out except for the ability to change the way you look at will. But it's really fascinating. What if you can just turn into an orc or dwarf?
Or all of those things in the past 3 seconds.
And what if you've lived, you know, for a year as each of those?
Right.
Yeah. And the Kalishtar have two minds. Sort of an ancestor spirit.
Yeah, I'm happy that we didn't have like a heavy feature of changelings, shifters, and Kalishtar in ours. They're certainly the more fringy of the races that got added in Eberron. I think Warforged are a little easier to explain given the role of artificers. I think they're fine. I think it's cool to have a magical construct. I think that could easily fit into other campaign settings. Changelings are going to really change the game for your low fantasy medieval, right?
I think each of the special races sort of fits a particular type of game, and we could have gone in any of those directions. Warforged certainly are about the battlefield and then the repercussions of the last war. Changelings are, if you want to play an intrigue game and you're an Eberron, you need to introduce them because they're something that you have to deal with.
Yeah, it's mystique at every turn.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. An entire race of mystiques.
Yeah.
The Kalishtar, if you guys had decided that you wanted to investigate the continents over the sea in the opposite direction from Arganesen, which is where you ended up going, then that's an entire continent run by the enemies of the Kalishtar who are very similar to them. It's a lot of analogs to communist China. And then if you decided to go north and have a more wilderness-based campaign, shifters would have been excellent.
Yeah, so shifters are literally werepeople, right?
Yeah, not quite lycanthropes. Shifters are to lycanthropes as changelings are to doppelgangers.
Exactly, yeah.
Another feature of Eberron that I played on heavily, and I think most people who run the setting do as well, is a heavy focus on dragons.
Yeah, there's a lot of dragons, but not in the main continent of Corvair. They're sort of sequestered down in Arganesen, sort of a separate continent that they run.
Yeah, I like the way that Eberron sort of deals with the odd question that comes up every time you play a fantasy setting, which is, okay, if there are a bunch of dragons and they're so super powerful, why don't they run everything?
Right.
And Eberron's answer is, well, they do.
Yeah.
But you're not important enough for them to care about you.
Right.
They're off doing all these other things. I mean, I think you guys didn't face a dragon until... You still haven't in the recount.
No, we haven't.
Yeah.
We haven't gotten Arganesen yet. Mm-hmm. Spoilers, we will get to Arganesen, but... Right.
Because it wouldn't have made sense
in
the setting.
Well, because they would have just eaten us.
Right. You don't have a dragon, like, flying around the countryside exposed. Or, like we said, it's relatively low magic. There wouldn't be a way for even an army in Eberron to handle a full-grown dragon.
Yeah. Well, an army, maybe.
Maybe, depending on the rules and if you're...
Magic items.
If you're using crits and...
Yeah.
But like we talked about before, there's the dragon-marked houses, and they're called dragon marks, but they don't necessarily look like dragons.
Oh, yeah. That's totally a false name.
Well, the reason they're called dragon marks is the entire thread of Eberron is based on what's called the Draconic Prophecy, which is, I'll be totally honest, totally GM fiat. It's supposed to be something that you can hang your plot on. The Draconic Prophecy is the reason that this thing occurred, or this confluence of circumstances. You can make anything happen for any reason because of the Draconic Prophecy.
Right.
You're
right.
Welcome. In fact, the prophecies that you guys have gotten, you later realize are part of the Draconic Prophecy.
Right. It's sort of got that like Wheel of Time thing.
Yeah.
Right. Where mm-hmm. the wheel keeps turning and it's just a matter of can you pick out the threads that mm-hmm. matter to you.
While we said that most of the setting is low level, there are powerful NPCs that are, well, statted out in 3.5. And honestly, that's pretty easy to transfer over to 5th edition.
And they're awesome.
Yeah. Great personalities.
I don't know about mechanically, but yeah, personality-wise, they are just fantastic representations.
Yeah, at this point, they take a little more time to like stat over. Although, like we said before, these aren't people that you're usually going to be fighting. King Bornal, I think he's level 12-ish.
Yeah.
He was, you know, a pretty strong fighter, but now he's a politician and a king, and he's thinking about turning his absolute monarchy into a constitutional monarchy.
Right.
The Keeper of the Flame is an 18th level cleric, and she's 11 years old.
Right. Well, she's also got the hounds, right?
Yeah, she has a giant dragon hound.
Yeah, so that helps.
I think he's only like in 3.5, like CR16 or something like that.
Oh, only. So. Only, yeah. So you got an 18th level PC and a 16th CR creature. Yeah, you'll be fine.
The head of one of the druidic orders is... We never got to this because you guys never hung out with the druids much.
No, because druids are lame.
But the head is actually, I think, canonically the most powerful character in Eberron, a level 20 druid. He's... an awakened great pine.
That's amazing. He's probably also the only level 20 character who's not a player character at the end of a campaign, right?
Yeah. Aside from, you know, if you assign CRs or levels to the dragons.
Well, right. Yeah. Right. Then you've also got, I don't know if we should keep this a secret, but you've also got one of the heads of state is secretly a vampire.
That's actually in like in a sidebar in the 3.5 like player book.
Oh, okay.
So yeah.
All right.
I think you guys sort of kind of knew that, but some of you sort of kind of didn't.
Well, we certainly found it out firsthand. It was one of those things where it was like, oh, he's here. And then it was like, oh, we're gonna have to fight him. And then I think Angela was like, oh, I remember this. Right. He's a really powerful vampire. Oh, crap.
And I said, maybe he is. Spoiler, he was.
Yeah.
I will say, as the GM who was running all of this, there's so many opportunities that you can't do them all in one campaign, so don't try to do them all in one campaign.
Yeah, but I think that's kind of getting into our next point, right, about the various tiers of play mm-hmm. that are supported. One of the great things about having a setting that's rich like this with a meta plot, but with lots of mysteries and holes in it to sort of questions to answer for yourself, you can shape the campaign however you want. And then you can play a campaign and then wipe it all clean.
Mm-hmm.
Answer that fundamental question of what caused the Day of Mourning. We know it had to do with House Caneth attempting to create a mass disjunction bomb in order to disjunct the Silver Flame, and it backfired because of a Rakshasa. That's not canon, right? That's just our game. So we could play another game in Eberron, which would be a totally different feel if that was just an accident,
mm-hmm.
like an honest-to-goodness accident, and no one claimed credit for it. Likewise, if it had been an actual weapon that could be repeated and somebody was holding the continent hostage, you'd have a very different feel to your Eberron game. And that gives you, sort of feeding into each tier of play, it can give you that intrigue at each level set. We started in the Caves of Chaos and we picked up one clue, this weird cube, right? And then from there, that got us to mid-level and then high-level, and then we eventually got to where we were 20th level and really even beyond that. From a power level kind of standpoint, mm-hmm. right? I like that Eberron is rich enough top to bottom that you never feel like you don't know where to start. Because I think that's one of the problems with some campaign settings is when you have Elminster and Drizzt running around, well, I can't do what they do. I can't do the cool stuff I'm reading about in the novels.
Yeah. Right?
This gives you a very street level campaign that can also grow to the sort of universe shaking kind of proportion.
Yeah. I also like that if, for example, we wanted to run another Eberron game in the exact same setting, the one where your old PCs were having their adventures, we could easily place it and have something else equally important happening in Corvair, and they would never cross over.
Yeah.
Yeah. It could have nothing to do with the fiendish overlords or even the Day of Mourning. It could be political intrigue between the Lazar principalities and the Morholds.
Sure.
And that would still be extraordinarily important on the face of the continent or maybe even the world.
Right. And our characters are too busy being super high powerful to care.
Well, you're handling that, right? But maybe some other party or your next party is preventing the Dalkeer incursion from underneath the Morholds.
Right.
And then maybe they also go to Arganessen and they talk to not the chamber, but the worst dragons.
Right. Wait, there's worse dragons?
Much, much worse. You talk to the nice ones. And they were jerks.
They were the nice ones? So we've hinted at this, and it's something that I've talked about a couple times that I like, but what are some of the other sort of secrets and mysteries that really resonate with you for Eberron?
I like that they're built in to the setting and usually don't actually have a canonical answer.
Mm-hmm.
But the backstory and the eventual machinations of the Blood of Vol have... I'm not going to go too deeply into it because I want to avoid spoilers, but they're... are a lot of different ways that you can go with it, and there are very rich characters in canon who can make all kinds of different decisions to further particular plots.
Are you talking about primarily Arandis Vol?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, that name exists in the book. It's not, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, you know she's out there. She is a very compelling character, I think, and really she's more compelling for the GM because, of course, the players are not going to find out about her sort of tragic backstory until the very end, if she does feature in a campaign.
Mm-hmm.
But she just has tendrils and fingers in everything.
Yeah.
She's very much moving things from behind the scenes and doing it at a pace that most humanoids won't notice because it happens too slowly that they'll die before things come to fruition.
Right, right.
Likewise, the fiendish overlords exist, but they've been dormant. Maybe they start to wake up, maybe they don't. Maybe that isn't this particular age.
Right. Well, then, I mean, you've got the Lords of Dust, right? And even if the fiendish overlords themselves aren't playing a part in your campaign, the Lords of Dust certainly could be. You don't have to necessarily have to deal with the Archfiend. You can deal with, I mean, Rakshasas are plenty of challenge, right? Mm-hmm.
And you've got an entire continent of just crazy ruined magic with Zendrick.
Zendrick, yeah.
And a broken continent shattered 40,000 years ago and the ruins of a giant civilization and drow who live on the surface.
Yeah, if that isn't an Indiana Jones campaign just waiting to happen, right? Just digging through crypts and you've got the remnants of the giant civilization on Zendrick. What killed the giants? Isn't that one of the fundamental questions as well? Like, what undermined the giants?
There are some questions around it. Okay. The dragons destroyed the giants.
Well, but it was why, right?
Yes, okay. Exactly. That is, some of that is certainly left up to the GM to decide.
Right.
And there are lots of different options. Yeah. And then it also ties into potential origins of the Warforged. So
sure.
I think it's great. So if you are a GM who wants to run all of this, there are plenty of source materials for you to choose from. Just not really in 5e.
Yeah, that's the downside, is you're going to be looking at a lot of 3.5.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, not too hard to convert.
Right. And fortunately, not too hard to find.
Yeah. It's all on DriveThru. Mm-hmm. So just go to DriveThruRPG. You can download the PDFs. And I wouldn't surprise me if you could find the books at a used bookstore, or even probably if you have a friendly local gaming store. It's possible if they still have 3.5 books, they might have some Eberron books. There were a ton of them.
And especially if, you know, they take things on consignment.
Right.
Sometimes there's always people wanting to get rid of old books.
Yeah. And it was split into a GM's book and a player's book. So there's sort of a player sanitized version of the campaign setting as well.
Right. And then since it was 3.5, just a ton of splat books covering very specific things. Faiths of Eberron, Races of Eberron.
Well, isn't there a splat book just for Sharn?
Yeah. City of Towers.
City of Towers, yeah. Yeah.
Which is one thing that I really like. You could, if you want, run an entire level 1 to 20 campaign just in the city of Sharn.
Yeah.
And there would absolutely be appropriate challenges the entire way through.
Right.
And still a great story. Another great resource is Keith Baker's Dragonmarks blog, where he still talks about his ideas for the setting and then really fleshes out a lot of the backstory.
Oh, yeah.
You can use it or not use it, but when I was trying to decide, okay, what is the end goal here for this particular fiendish overlord? Or, you know, what is the domain of a particular Lazar pirate? I would just do search on his blog and see what he had riffed on.
I mean, I would say that Keith Baker is one of the best parts of the setting, right? He has just gone so far above and beyond the Call of Duty in supporting it. He still answers questions about it. He used to jump in on forums to answer questions. I guess he had free time at night.
Yeah, I think it's a bit tragic that the Wizards forums have sort of been deleted because you could find his avatar and then look at his previous posts and they're just information, all this free information about Eberron.
Right, exactly. Even at Gen Con, he still does every year. He does he does a series of panels, but then he always does like a sort of informal get together where he talks about the games that he's made, and obviously Eberron features heavily in that. I told my Keith Baker story on probably episode like 4 or 5. Having dinner with him and talking about our campaign at Gen Con, right, is just amazing. He's just a great guy,
and him still being interested in stories about Eberron even though he's had to have heard all of them.
I mean, so, and probably like some of the worst stories. Like, I don't think that ours is like too bad and like the bonkersness, but I bet there are people who just took his setting and just trashed it. You know, like it was a nice house when he left it, and like they ripped stuff off the wall. There's holes in the wall. The furniture's all turned over. There's glass shattered everywhere.
You're gonna need to pay me for the book again.
Right. Yeah. But yeah, he's just such a great part of the Eberron setting. So it's awesome to have an author who's that likable and that engaged. But there are some drawbacks.
There are a few. We mentioned that one of the things that we really don't like about Forgotten Realms is that the timeline keeps moving forward. So it's really hard to stay up to date with what's current in the setting. Eberron's timeline doesn't move. It never gets advanced. It's always 2 years after the Day of Mourning. Now, I personally like that, but certain players and certain GMs, I think, will feel like, okay, this is a bit stagnant. What's going on?
Right. Yeah, it isn't a living campaign setting the way that Greyhawk and Forgotten Realms are.
Right.
Well, Greyhawk was. Forgotten Realms is.
It's really the Warforged of campaign setting.
Right.
It will always go on being the same. Does it have a soul? It has soul.
I mean, that is a drawback, though. Saying it's the Warforged of campaign settings, fitting, because there aren't currently Warforged in 5e. So to play Eberron today is going to require homebrew.
Right, to say nothing of like Kalashtar.
Yeah. Right, yeah, Warforged are amongst the easier because there was Unearthed Arcana for it, but even if you take 3.5 as the inspiration, you had to create feats for the Dragon Marks to map those abilities, and there's currently nothing in 5e that really maps well to that, because a feat that scales up in power is way too powerful. And so either you lose sort of the iconic abilities of the Dragon Mark, or you end up investing multiple feats, which is extremely expensive, you know? So you just run into this, it just sits in a weird place, right? And then you've got classes, the Artificer. They took a stab at it. It is awful. It is awful. I think Keith Baker has a much better version on his website that's based on the Cleric. If that tells you how far off 5e is. Right.
The Unearthed Arcana Artificer is Mastermind bad.
Yeah. Like, worse than Mastermind, actually. At least the Master... No. I don't know. They're both bad.
They're both terrible.
So you've got to be ready for that.
Right. If you are someone who played Eberron before and you want to get back into it now, it does take a lot of work to sort of get you back to having all of those iconic options available.
Yeah. I'm going to say it's a drawback because it's sort of my personal preference, but I also don't love that it's a kitchen sink setting. I think if it had been tightened up a little bit and hadn't been forced to use every single bit of rule and splat book that was available, and that was one of the parameters of the contest, if it had been tightened up a little bit, if they had maybe cut out the psionics, right? Like, the Kalashtar are cool, but it just creates this whole other thing.
They did put them on the other side of the world.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. I mean, they put them as far away, so they're not core. You know, it's like, so there's little choices like that I sort of struggle with. But then, you know, for every one of those, you've got halflings riding dinosaurs.
Totally canon.
Right.
They're the second coolest halflings I know of.
Who are the first?
Dark Sun's cannibal halflings.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah, I don't have any more drawbacks because I just love it.
Yeah, I'm out.
Let's open it up to the listeners. If you've played Eberron, if there's something that you don't like about Eberron, let us know. And if there's something that you do like that we've overlooked, let us know on Twitter.
Yeah, we always need more reasons to play Eberron. And do you remember way back Wizards did a survey to figure out what percentage of the gaming public plays each campaign setting?
Yeah.
I think Eberron was 5%.
Which means 1 in 20 people.
That seems very low.
Yeah, but we have a few hundred followers. So that means like 20 of them, 15 of them.
Well, there might be some self-selection going on.
Yeah. I would love to hear what other people think about Eberron as well.
Yeah. And like we've said before, so Ravenloft is back, like we talked about last episode.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want Eberron to come back, the only way to really do that is to make it more popular.
Right. Do you hear that, Ishan?
Is that the sound of the day of mourning?
No, I think that was a little louder.
Okay.
That is the sound of the Character Creation Forge. But before we do that, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane at Mundangerous. That's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan at Evil Sans Carne. That's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show to tell us how much you love or hate Eberron at TPTcast.
You can also email that to us if you can't fit it into 140 characters at totalpartythrill@gmail.com.
And you can find us on the web at www.totalpartythrillcast.com.
So this week on the Character Creation Forge, we decided to do something Eberron specific.
Yeah, it's almost as if we had a theme.
Probably not. So we wanted to build something that was dissimilar to things that we've built before. And it struck us that Eberron has a lot of very well-defined druidic sects.
Yeah. Druids aren't really our favorite class, personally, right?
Yeah. And it doesn't mesh that well in general with other classes, so there's not much of a reason to dip or to multi-class out of it. Yeah. It has such an amazing capstone.
Yeah. We generally, when people ask about druids, we just recommend take 20 levels of druid.
Yeah.
You're a great druid.
Uh-huh. That's a perfectly great class.
Right.
Yeah.
But in this case, we have the Gatekeeper Druid.
So the Gatekeepers are a small but very influential sect of druids. They are responsible for sealing away Eberron's far realm called Zoriat 9,000 years ago. That prevented an incursion of aberrations into the material plane. And ever since then, they've been tending to the seals. So they are focused on hunting, killing, and banishing aberrations. And also, they're very martially inclined. The Faith of Eberron book says that a lot of them aren't even actually druids. They're mostly rangers and fighters and things that can kill aberrations.
Yeah, which is fitting because our build also mostly isn't a druid.
What is our build?
So our build is Vengeance Paladin 14, Ranger 1, Druid 5.
Ranger 1?
Yeah, you know, it's a splash.
I mean, if there's any time to take it, it's on this character that hates aberrations.
Yeah, exactly, because you'll get your favorite enemy.
We were thinking about taking more druid, but it's not really that helpful if you're not going to be a caster. Or if you're not going to fight in animal form.
Well, you said a magic word, and that sort of became our focus. That word was banish. So in order to banish the aberrations, you might want the banishment spell.
But druids don't get it.
And it's a fourth level spell, which makes it a pretty expensive dip from any other class from a full caster. And it just feels like that gets further away from the druid core.
Right. Especially a gatekeeper. You wouldn't have, you know, 11 levels of wizard in there.
Right.
Or you know, 9 levels of cleric.
Yeah. And I proposed warlock, but even the archfey warlock doesn't really fit. And thematically, it's about tricksiness, less about nature. So and
gatekeepers are pretty serious.
Right.
So, you know, Vengeance Paladin, they're pretty serious too.
There's the Ancient Paladin, though. And that's what kills me, is the Oath of the Ancients made so much flavor sense, but it doesn't get banishment.
Well, here's what I'll say. The Oath of the Ancients, I think, works really well for a Warden of the Wood, which is another druidic sect that's much more mainstream.
Okay, fair enough.
The gatekeepers are almost... they're actually pretty nice to deal with, but pretty almost fanatical in dealing with aberrations. So I think Vengeance Paladin works really well, especially because you found out level 14 gets banishment.
Yeah. Well, level 13 gets banishment.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah. The 14th level is just, you know, getting an extra caster level. And it gives you the ability to end spells that are affecting you or an ally.
Right. Cleansing touch, nice when your friends have been taken over by a horrible abomination.
Right. Yeah. You could just end that. And, you know, there's lots of lasting effects with aberrant magic type things, mind flayers, that sort of thing. So it's nice to just have a one action to fix it.
Right. You've got a bunch of smites.
5 levels of druid. Right. Still smiteable.
You've got favorite enemy. You've got all of the paladin goodies. You got improved divine smite, so already your normal attacks are doing a bunch of damage.
Yeah, I'm happy with it. It's not the most powerful paladin build, but I feel like it gets the flavor right.
Yeah, and it's a little bit mad. You know, you want wisdom, charisma, and strength.
Yeah, well, you're probably only going to keep 13 wisdom, I would guess.
Yeah, I would say you would probably use those druid spells for utility.
Yeah, instead of taking offensive spells that are going to require an attack roll or a saving throw.
Right. Good berry.
Yeah. Handy heels.
That's right. Handful of good berries.
Right.
All right. So who is your gatekeeper?
He is an angry young man.
Role playing, Shane. Role playing.
No, I think he is. I think my gatekeeper is actually the son or daughter of 2 other gatekeepers.
Oh, that's very rare.
Yeah, I think that's how I would play it, where, and they were both lost to incursions, right? So that explains the vengeance piece of it, right? It's a personal loss for him. It's not just an ideal, in which case I would say a different oath would make more sense. I think that anger is coming from a very personal loss.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you learn how to be a druid / ranger as a gatekeeper, right? That's part of being in the sect.
Ah, so that's what brought them to the gatekeepers, right?
Vengeance yeah, first. I would guess that probably parents didn't die at level 1.
Mm-hmm.
They probably died after he was already initiated as a druid.
I like that.
Which might not be an optimal build, but
it's cool.
It's fine.
Yeah.
How about your gatekeeper?
I think mine starts out as a normal druid, not a gatekeeper. Just interested in nature, likes animals, but in the Eldine Reaches, things are sometimes dangerous, and there are often incursions from Zoriat.
Mm-hmm.
Or from horrible things that were trapped underneath when Zoriat was sealed away.
Mm-hmm.
And likewise, I mean, if you're going Vengeance Paladin, their family died. Their family was killed, and then they set upon figuring out a way to enact this vengeance.
Yeah.
And I think, sort of like we talked about in the character advancement episode, you sort of have to decide at this point, you've got some druid levels, what is the most optimal way for this character in-game to find and kill aberrations? Do they go Vengeance Paladin first or Ranger to track them down? And I think being Druid, they go Ranger first and then probably meet other more martially inclined people as they're, you know, learning to be a Ranger and hang out with more scouts. And then I think they probably meet another Paladin.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see that.
I think with both of ours, neither of us mentioned a god. And in Eberron, you can just be a paladin.
Right.
You don't have to have a god.
Yeah, paladin is just a job.
Yeah.
It's not a calling.
And so I think I certainly would. Although I could see maybe Church of the Silver Flame, because they're pretty militant and pretty crazy. And they're in that area anyway. That's where they killed the shifters.
Yeah. Yeah, I could buy that.
Okay, I think mine saw didn't see, because the shifter genocide was like 80 years ago.
But like learned about
the learned about it and didn't go, oh god, that's awful. Said, well, that was effective.
Right. It's like, who's next up?
Yeah. You know what I want to do?
Right. All right. If you want to support the show, the easiest way to do that is to leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And if you're willing to help us out and leave us a review, we'll read it on the air.
You can also find us on Stitcher. That's like a Pandora for podcasts. If you like or favorite us there, the algorithm will help other people find us.
So what do we have planned for next week's episode?
We're actually discussing why we play D&D.
And in the Character Creation Forge?
We're building a Sister of Battle from Warhammer 40K.
We're not continuing the theme of what's your favorite D&D class to build in D&D classes?
Didn't we already do that in the year-end best of?
Kind of.
I can talk about my favorite character.
Oh, we also did the Swashbuckler.
Oh, yeah, we did Swashbuckler twice.
Yeah, we've already built classes.
You want to do another Grappler?
No, absolutely not.
How about a pacifist?
All right, before any worse ideas come up, that's it for episode 33 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we've lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.